Rediscovered Radio, women's voices, women's music from the WYSO archives is brought to you in part by the Levitt Pavilion in downtown Dayton. Building community through music, one free concert at a time.
I gotta tell you, making a podcast about women's voices in the WYSO archives has been a blast. I'm Jocelyn Robinson, Director of Radio Preservation and Archives here at WYSO. Not only are we mining the archives and creating content for the podcast, but we're actually creating future content for the archives as well. As both producer and preservationist, I find that's pretty meta. So here's a little bonus episode for you of Rediscovered Radio, Women's Voices, Women's Music in the WYSO Archives. Early on, I had the chance to sit down for a long conversation with Nina Ellis, former WYSO general manager and longtime audio producer, where we explored WYSO's past and the women who lived it. If you listened to our first episode, Making Change, Women's Voices on WYSO, you'll remember my co-host Juliet Frumholt and me talking about how women were involved in WYSO's transition from a college station to a community station with news, documentaries, and lots of great music. Nina had more to tell me about those days. We talked about the late Julia Reichert's legacy, Joanne Wallace's public media trajectory, and of course, Nina's own journey as a woman in public radio. It was a great way to get this project started. Here's our conversation in full for your listening pleasure. So we're here this morning. It's May 22nd already to talk about...
Let's say the year.
19. Yeah, my head is in 1969 right now because of the subject matter. But it is 2023 already.
I'm always shocked at when people never say the year. On tape, they say the date, and they don't say the year. You see music posters, you see newspaper articles, nobody says the year. And when you start doing the research, you're like, wah!
Oh, I hate it when they don't put it on posters and stuff like that. It's like, how do you know? How do you know when this was?
I know.
Anyway, big concert posters, you know, with like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan, and it's like, when was this?
Think about the future, people.
So we are here to talk about the past and how it has had an impact on the present and the future as that continuum always exists. And we're talking about the legacy of Julia Reichert in relation to women and music at WYSO. Not just music, I think women and media, women and radio. And I'm here with Nina Ellis, who is Julia's friend and who has spent a lot of time with her professionally as well as personally. And I want to ask you a couple questions about Julia's experience here at WYSO and how it had an impact on her life as a filmmaker. You know, going back to 1969, as I said, there was a radio show here at WYSO that, by all accounts, really broke ground. And if you could say a few words about that, that would be interesting to start.
So back in those days, it was very free form, right? Very free form format. And there were a lot of students involved, as well as people in the community. And from what I gather, there would be like quarterly meetings. And they would say, you know, if you're interested in doing a program, come and sign up. So people would come and sign up for, you know, like I think typically a co-op period, right? Not a co-op period. What did they call them?
They had quarters back
quarters,
then.
Quarters, right. People would sign up for quarters. And Julia signed up for to do a program. And she had been very actively participating in what she refers to as consciousness-raising groups, where a group of women would get together outside of class and talk about the patriarchy and, you know, how society was creating norms for women's behavior that they didn't agree with, right? So they were discovering what Julia joyfully called Women's Liberation. She emphasized that. We called it Women's Liberation. She says, think about that. Think about those words. And that was life-changing, I think I would say. It was life-changing for her. It set her on a path because she didn't come from a background that would have necessarily pointed her in that direction, right? She grew up in New Jersey, kind of a rural part of New Jersey, working-class family. She says, you know, there weren't that many books in their house, and she was a super curious questioner, always questioning things. So Antioch was a big changing point in her life, and this period of time when she was talking with these other women, I think, really underscored for her, set her on a path, right? So she did this program. She says, you know, that she picked the music and she got some women, some of her friends, to read excerpts from various writings. I don't know exactly what books or essays they were reading from, but they were reading things that had probably been part of their discussion groups, right? And she would intercut popular music of the day with those readings. And she called it the single girl. And it's super entertaining, I think, still to listen to. And the stunning variety of music, you know, everything from Aretha to the Rolling Stones to super folky folk music, right? I mean, it's pretty folky. So this, again, you know, she had a wide-ranging curiosity, and her musical tastes are reflected in that as well. So I don't know how many programs she did. I don't know how many years it went on, but it was something that people took note of, right? It was a turning point, not just for Julia, for WISO. She, all her life, she credited WISO with really teaching her how to tell stories. She had a photographer's eye. She loved photography. She came to WISO with skill in photography, but she had never edited audio before. And when you edit audio, you understand structure, right, of how a story is put together. You make a beginning, a middle, and an end. You look for emotion. You look for exposition. You know, you learn how to tell the difference between the two when you're physically editing. And in those days, it was physical editing of audio, right? It was quarter-inch tape, cut it with a razor blade. Film was also cut that way, you know, physically cut. So this skill that she learned of how to edit audio served her for the rest of her life, right? The physical act of cutting, but also the importance of audio in a film. She knew right away, something that she spent the rest of her teaching career talking to her students about. Sound in film is very important. It's not an afterthought. You know, you have to think about it ahead of time, not just the spoken word, but the sound, right? There were people here who, there were people at WISO when Julia was here who learned those lessons all together, and they went on to have careers in as media makers, right? They learned those skills as very young people in a laboratory, which was WISO, right? They were given the opportunity to try things out. When things busted open here in the late 60s, that's what resulted, was all these young people who were just trying out learning skills and telling the stories that they wanted to tell, right? So Julia was a big part of that energy. And I think, from what I can tell, she probably, knowing her the way I did, was encouraging other people to do the same thing, right? You know, I can do this, you can do this too.
Right. So what I understand, too, is that after Antioch and after WISO, a group of folks from here moved to Dayton and lived together, lived communally, and were making media that was in support of community activism.
Exactly. They called it the Media House, and she and Jim Klein lived there, several other people who are still in the area. And they did something, they had these events, these happenings, right, in the parks, in the city parks. They showed films, they played music, they had little political, you know, drama. They invited the community to come, and they wanted just to build community through media making and media sharing, right? It was very 60s idea. And they wanted to bring it alive in Dayton. And this is like, Julia was not from Dayton, right? She had made a decision to stay in the Midwest from coming from New Jersey. So she was putting down roots here and getting to know Dayton in a very intimate way, you know, person by person, neighborhood by neighborhood. So, yeah, that group of people forged their own skills and went on to make media from that experience at the Media House. Also, Julia made a film with Jim.
What's it called? Growing Up Female.
Growing Up Female. And if you, I really think people need to track it down. It's kind of amazing, I think. It's awkward. It's a little bumbly here and there. But what is super clear is, number one, Julia's relentless questioning, asking, not grilling. It wasn't, you know, like she didn't know what she was going for, but she was pushing people. Why did you do that? Why did they tell you that? Why do you think that? It's just like amazing, because that part of her was there early on. She says it herself. I was curious, and boy, can you hear it in that first film. They were young, you know? And my favorite story about Growing Up Female is that they edited it, they finished it, they were shopping it around looking for a distributor. They got an offer from a distribution company. This is a more complicated story than I'm able to tell, but they turned down the offer. They turned it down because they didn't get the rights and the conditions that they wanted, right? It was their first film. But when they did finally make a distribution deal, they spent the next several years making copies of the film, sending out copies of the film, writing to people. It was very much hand-marketed, right? And that's a good amount of the activity that was going on at Media House was also related to the distribution.
You know, I wonder, because this is around the same time that it, I think, emerged, that the influence that grassroots media making had, that Julia and Jim and others were working on, had an influence on the Living Arts Center, because media was a part of that. You know, we're going to look at it in terms of its support of traditional musics and bluegrass and the engagement with the Appalachian diaspora. But it seems to me that there was, that Dayton had this sort of like undercurrent of people who were about making media, and it was about community. It wasn't, you know, the next big Hollywood, you know, film that they were working on or anything like that. But and I think that also had a relationship with WISO and WISO's presence in Dayton, that there was not just an opportunity to record, or not record, but to broadcast the bluegrass concerts, but WISO actually had a studio and a news division taking place in Dayton at the Victoria.
Right. They had a studio down there somewhere. I'd never been able to track it down, but yes, they had a studio. What was happening at WISO was also part of a movement, right? So they had just come out of Kent State, right? And that really mobilized a lot of students in the Midwest, right? And people from here immediately got in their cars and drove up there to collect tape, right, to interview people, brought it back, put it on the air. And in those early years, they were sharing programming with other stations as well. So when you go in our collection, our archives collection, you'll find tapes from other places. They were mailing them to each other. There was no satellite distribution. There was no digital hit send, right? They were making programs, making dubs of them in real time. So if you made an hour-long program, it took an hour to make a copy of it, right? There's no fast-speed dubbing in WISO. And then they would mail it to another radio station and ask them to air it. And they would, you know, there was some kind of a network of stations. So they understood, they were beginning to understand that this was bigger than them, right? This was students. This was young people. This was the young revolution, right? There was a revolution happening in this country where young people were empowered to do a lot of things, and media was one of them. Media was one. There was theater. There was music. There was, you know, all kinds of explosions of creativity from that generation of people, and media was one. And WISO was a place where that was fostered, you know, and nurtured. Got the skills. You got a studio, right? You got a tape recorder, you know. You got the resources that you needed. You got help learning how to do it. That's what WISO was for. We're going to help you, right? We're going to let you do what you feel empowered to do. We're going to give you permission. It wasn't that way in commercial radio. It was not that way. It wasn't even that way in a lot of university licensees. This was a community-based station, and there was a much more freedom here. It was much more open than it would have been in a lot of places.
So when Joanne comes on the scene, she had been in California for college, and she was young too. You know, we think of her as the sort of the mother of the WISO movement from the 70s. But she was 28 years old when she came to first volunteer at WISO in 1969. So she had been exposed to KPFA, and that was a model that she saw that she believed WISO could adopt. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about what KPFA was like back then?
Yes. KPFA, some people say, was the first community station in the world, right? Probably an exaggeration, but it was the first of the Pacifica stations, Pacifica was founded in 1949, I think. KPFA went on the air in 1949, and it was an anti-war, World War II movement, right? It was a pacifist movement that generated that energy. And it was a community. It was a community licensee in Berkeley, okay? Berkeley. The Bay Area was just on fire with alternative ways of thinking, right? There was an Eastern philosophy had arrived on the West Coast. There was a huge music scene, a huge poetry scene, a huge spoken word. It's, you know, there was a blossoming of the underground and alternative, whatever you want to call that culture, began in some ways. It was New York and Berkeley, right? And KPFA was right there. And there were women on the air, so she heard women on the air, too, and she knew that that was great. One of the founders of Pacifica was a woman. So it was a different, you know, Berkeley, KPFA, different mindset, right? So Joanne comes here and she sees those same strains possible, right? You got students, you got hippie community members, you got conservative community members, you got bluegrass, you got jazz, you have blacks, you have whites, you have this incredible mix of people coming together at WISO the way they were in San Francisco. To her, it's completely normal. To her, it's totally thrilling, right? Yes, let this happen. So what Joanne, in my opinion, probably, she made it possible. She said, yes, come in here, do this. We'll teach you. Go in the air. Let's try it. Very experimental. Open to change. Open to new ideas. Open to awkwardness on the air. Open to lack of quote-unquote professionalism. People fumbling around, trying it out on the air, trying to be funny, being funny. So she had a tolerance for that huge mix of talent that came together here. And because she'd already heard it, and she knew that it worked. And she had an opportunity to do something and be engaged, and this was her, you know, the venue that was available to her. She didn't come here to do this, right?
Right,
she came as a faculty wife.
Right.
And this came available.
Right. And I think in the course of this story, it's really interesting that, you know, a woman's role was as the hostess, was as the protocol officer, that was the one who was about the human relations of others, you know, on campus. And I'm sure there were women faculty at the time, but probably not a whole lot. You know, so as that the 50s gave way into the 60s and the 60s gave way into the 70s, and Joanne does talk about it in our interview that, you know, women were realizing that what they had thought were their lives would be like, maybe they weren't going to be that way, and maybe they had some options that they didn't realize that they had earlier on. And it's exciting to me to see how those handoffs are being made in this early time when, you know, Jim Klein and Julia are in this space of discovery themselves, and they're training other people how to use this medium to also make those explorations on their own. And when Joanne came, that she was ready for that she had it was familiar to her, but she had the imagination to take it even further, because let's face it. You know, the Dayton area is not the Bay Area, and it perhaps did have a lot to do with the sort of critical lens that was prevalent at the time, which was Marxism, which was this view of workers and of the people as a power, and sort of a sleeping giant of that could be motivated and educated and inspired to do more and to push back, not against just the patriarchy, but, you know, the status quo in all things. So,
right. Well, let's remember, too, that Dayton was different, you know, a lot more union members in Dayton at that time, right? After World War II, when there was a big explosion of manufacturing work that was available here, a lot of people came to work at GM, to work at Delco, to work in factories, and there were a lot of union, you know, sentiment here. So that played into WISO as well. I think that Dayton was a democratic community in the late 60s, right? LBJ came here to speak. There was a lot of protest around the war. There was a lot of student pushback at Wright-Patt. There were, you know, protests outside the gates there. It was just like the rest of the country. But Dayton was a little different, I think, demographically then than it is now. But still mixed, you know, racially mixed. And these young people were, you know, embracing that, right? They were tapping into that and holding it forth as a you know, something that we should honor and hear. We should hear from all these different, you know, points of view. What they were hearing on commercial broadcasting was not like that. It was very different. So, yeah, they saw an opportunity, and WISO was giving them the tools, and they ran. They ran with it. I don't know as much about the Living Arts Center as you do, but I do know that there was so much engagement there from people here. So I can only imagine that it had a similar atmosphere.
Yeah, I think it was one of these places when you walked into the building, it was buzzing. It was humming with creativity and with community and engagement and community involvement, multi-generational, multiracial. Some of it was art. Some of it was more practical. I mean, there was a lot of things going on. I think it might be in and of itself a topic for a story at some point. I don't think we don't have collectives like that today that drew their energy really from the community in that same way. Yeah, I'd like to learn more about it too.
Mm-hmm.
So with all of this going on, Joanne didn't leave until 1977. So there was like 4 years where when she became the station manager in 73, and then by that point Julia was in Dayton doing the media work and ultimately finding her way to Wright State and training, educating, nurturing, really nurturing several generations of filmmakers, again, in the heartland, in the Midwest, in a regional university. And I think that legacy stands all on its own, mm-hmm. as well. Interestingly, with Joanne, she leaves and goes to KPFA. And all I could get from her was that it was a wild and woolly year, and she ends up at WGBH, which to me seems sort of the polar opposite of a KPFA type space. More stolid and
yeah.
And not so much conservative, but stolid. I don't know why that word keeps coming to mind.
Probably so.
So by this time, Nina Ellis, where are you in 1977?
I was just finishing college in 1977. I was in Iowa, and I had been a journalism student. And just coming, you know, out of that in trying to figure out, you know, what was my next step going to be. And I went back to Indiana, where I'm from, for about a year. And then I jumped in my car, and I moved to Washington, D.C., where in about 9 months, I got a job at NPR. I worked at the local public radio station. I got hired there and then went to NPR, which is where I met Joanne. And I met John McChesney, who was her partner, who had also been here at WISO. There were others there as well, notably Gary Covino, who talked constantly about WISO. He had such a formative experience at WISO and doing, I don't know exactly what his program was called, but it was like kind of a talk radio monologue with music. Here's what I think.
Some radio drama too. I think he
could have been.
He did some radio drama.
But very political. I remember him talking a lot about a program he did about Dennis Kucinich, who was a young up-and-coming Democrat in Cleveland at that time. But again, it was that freedom, that permission that people had here to just try something. And at NPR, it was not that open, but it was pretty good. You know, we were, you know, NPR only started in 71. So it was pretty new when I got there, less than 10 years. Same with Gary, same with Joanne, same with John. There were others, Joanne Kaywell, who had been here at WISO. And we were inventing something new. You know, All Things Considered had been on the air for several years, but in a state of constant change. Morning Edition hadn't gone on the air yet. So there was this invention of Morning Edition going on. And at that time, people didn't really know that much. Not that many people knew about NPR. I was hired as a tape editor. And, you know, sometimes I would make phone calls and tell people, ask them a question. And they didn't know what NPR was. You know, they thought it was public television. It's what they thought. So it was a similar, you know, let's make a show kind of place. And a lot, very young, you know. I remember when a first staff member had a kid, right? I mean, there weren't even that many people with kids around in those early days. So it felt very experimental, even though it was more structured. It was a corporation. It had money from the CPB. You know, it was a more corporate, I guess, than WISO was for sure. But it just didn't feel that way. It felt you didn't have a lot of conversation with management, right? It was us down there making programs like crazy from morning till night, and then the show would be over and we'd go out for a drink and then we'd come back and do it again the next day. So it felt very free and very open. And, you know, I was, you know, given the chance to try things and here, want studio time? Here's a studio. I mean, there was a lot more yes than there was no in those days. It felt that way to me. And as it got bigger and more bureaucratic, it changed. But those probably first 10, 15 years were pretty, pretty fun.
So Joanne was in the mix, and there were other women who were in that sort of experimental early...
Lots.
Young NPR time?
Lots of women. You know, Cokie Roberts was there. Nina Totenberg was there. Linda Wertheimer was there. There was a woman named Barbara Cohen who was the news director right when I got there. Show producers were women. Lots of reporters, lots of editors.
Susan,
not to mention Susan Stamberg, who was the host of All Things Considered. So, yeah, it never felt to me the way commercial radio had felt, which is like you'd go and you'd always felt like you were the only woman. You know, you felt weird, you know, people like making comments to you about the fact that you were the only woman. It just wasn't that way at NPR. It just wasn't. So I felt really lucky to not have that, you know, break put on. It was a pretty open atmosphere.
So you learned about WISO back then, of course, from Joanne, but and from others. What was it that you learned?
Well, that it was experimental, you know, that people had freedom to make what they wanted to make. Honestly, some of what I heard about it sounded like, okay, but programming-wise, but just the atmosphere was something that was attractive to me, right? Where the door is open, right? People can come in and learn how to do it and then get really good at it. Because for me, audio, learning how to make radio programs was just so freeing and so exciting. You know, I still get excited when I mix a piece of music under a piece of copy, right? That happened to me for the first time in public radio. And I had worked in commercial radio, right? But it wasn't until I was at a public radio station that I learned to cut tape and learned to mix music under something. And honestly, when I did that, I thought I was going to explode. I was just amazed. I was amazed, charmed, excited. And, you know, that excitement has never left me, you know, like, let's try this piece of music under this, you know, let's see what happens if we, It's so personal and so intimate. And so, you know, you can hear people breathing. You can hear people crying. You can hear what people are not saying, you know, and you're not looking at what they look like. You know, it's heart to heart. That's what I love about radio. And that's what I really learned in public radio. I didn't learn that so much in commercial radio. It was like, get this clip, get it on the air. I was just making newscasts, you know, every hour for 12 hours a day.
So it's cool to see how WISO contributed, what was happening here, what Julia was doing, and Jim, and so many others who were on the air at the time that Joanne again was a part of bringing into that intimacy, and then she took it out into the world, and that was really part of the formative years of NPR.
Mm-hmm. And Joanne knew very well what the beginning of NPR was like. She wasn't there at the beginning, but she knew. She was the one who applied to get WISO CPB funding, right? And she wrote the application, and she knew what they were looking for, right? And she knew that WISO had it, right? And when they got the application back, the feedback they gave her was that they loved the spirit of innovation that was here. It distinguished WISO's application from a lot of others, you know. So she was listening very closely to what was on the air at NPR and hearing what, you know, could be at WISO. We didn't have the resources. We didn't have, you know. But that was all in one piece in her mind, you know. Like, here's what NPR's doing. Here's what we're doing. We could bring these two things together, right? So she went to NPR actually as an administrator. She was a manager. What her job title was?
It was like something about news development or something like that.
Yeah, she was like an assistant to the news director. Yeah. And she would help plan budgeting and expansion. So I'm sure that, you know, Joanne was looking at spreadsheets when they were trying to plan when are they going to launch Morning Edition. You know, because she had that experience at WISO. You know, we got to corral all this energy into something, right, into programming and to a program guide and to a way to communicate it to the listeners, right? She had that vision, you know, a little above, hot, not above, but different from a person who was making programs, right? We have to get people to support this. We have to be able to explain it. We have to be able to tell people what its purpose is, right? So she had that from WISO, and NPR just, at NPR, that just grew and grew and grew.
I love how you need, or we needed, all of that kind of diverse passion, expertise, vision for makers like Julia and people like Joanne who could, you know, sort of carve out the pathway for the makers to be able to make.
Mm-hmm. And also for the technical people, you know. The launch of WISO was a technical accomplishment, right? Because to get a license, an FCC license, is not easy, was not easy then. To get a transmitter, to get the studios built, it was a perfect place to make that happen because there were so many engineering students. That's why in those early days, two of those three guys were engineering experts, right? And self-motivated to use what they'd learned at Antioch to make a radio station happen, right? And Ed Richard, who was the first manager, he has a great administrative skill, right? And he can explain the purpose. He got on a bus and went to New York. He got on a bus and went to Buffalo to ask somebody for money, right? Because they needed $10,000 to get the station up and running. And he got it, right? I love that. So, yeah, you're right. It's not just people making the makers. It takes more than that. You need the infrastructure to let it grow and to be healthy, right, so that the makers can keep doing it and have more and more resources and grow in their making, right? So, yeah, Julia was in a really nice moment where that was all being taken care of, you know, to some degree by people like Joanne.
You know, the other part of it that we don't talk about very much is that technical piece and really how Wiseau did all of this with equipment that, let's say, it wasn't the top of the line. And there were often workarounds and cobbling together of the resources to keep the station on the air. And it actually did go off the air quite a bit,
yeah.
during parts of its existence. But even thinking about, you know, some of the, you know, like a Randy Tom who is the technical sort of whiz kid that came out of that period of time. And there are others. And, you know, even Jim Klein coming in as a student, he was a music major who ended up, you know, learning this technology and becoming so adept at it that even when, you know, the transmitter went down or things went sideways, you know, they figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
They never gave up. They never, you know, threw up their hands and walked away from this and said, we can't do this because we don't have what we need to do it.
Yeah.
They made it happen. And
yeah.
that sort of can-do sort of attitude, or it's a different kind of creativity, but creativity nonetheless, to take something that isn't working and make it work.
Mm-hmm. You bet. A small example of that, when things aren't working and you need to make it work. You know that tape was expensive. Quarter-inch tape was expensive. And often tape was re-recorded, you know, because you couldn't afford to buy new tape. So they would re-record their programs over old programs, right? So the first time we went to transfer some of that old audio, the guy who did it said, you can't believe in some of these spots, another program pops up because they were recording over old programs. So it's just a small example of, yeah, you make do. You make do.
Yeah, I had no idea, too, how dependent on the phone lines the radio station was back in those days.
Yeah. Well, even NPR. NPR was distributed by phone lines until the early 80s when they got the satellite system. So you would turn it on in your home or on your car radio, and what you were hearing was coming down a phone line. I mean, when you go back and listen to some of those programs, you're like, what? So, yeah, it's just mind-bending how far it's come.
So it has come a long way, and I think we'll kind of circle this around and ask you about really the reflection that you have on, you know, what it's like to be part of this larger legacy that, you know, began with those lines being stretched through the steam tunnels at the college, but also that grew and I think blossomed is a wonderful word into these experiments, to Julia's legacy here, to Joanne's and beyond to NPR and to an Academy Award winning film career, community based. All where do you see that legacy for you with these women in public media?
Well, I would not be where I am without the example and the encouragement of people like Julia and Joanne and many, many women at NPR. Susan Stamberg was a very powerful presence in my life. I cut her interviews for years and produced a lot of programs with her and, you know, learned writing. Susan's a phenomenal writer for radio. So, you know, my editing station was right outside her office door for many years, right outside. So she could hear what I was doing. She would say, okay, that's good, leave that in. Or, you know, or she'd call and she'd say, hey, come in here and listen to this. And she'd have a tape that she was trying to make some decisions about. And another person I want to mention is Deborah Amos, who was a producer when I got there. There was a newscaster named Diane Diamond who was like legendary on the air. There were so many. I can't name them all. The Kitchen Sisters came to NPR from San Francisco, so I met them, and they're a completely different style of producing. I don't know. They encouraged me. They were my friends. They were my mentors. They were my, you know, shining examples. And yet still, I felt like I had the freedom to do what I wanted to do and to follow my own voice, which is part of why I left NPR after, 10 years there on staff. I decided that I needed to be a producer on my own, and I went off and did that, but never lost touch with those folks, those women. And, you know, still today, I'm in touch with many of them, most of them. So I think we all felt very connected and very invested in each other's success. You know, it wasn't jealousy. It wasn't rivalry. It was like, hey, can you help me with this? I don't know how to do this. Can you show me how to do this? Have you ever done this? That's the kind of atmosphere it was. So I just, how did I get so lucky? You know, it was just great. And I should say a little bit, I came out of a commercial radio background. My parents had a small radio station, and my dad had been on the air since 1948. And he worked at stations in Northwest Indiana. And he would take me with him on Saturdays sometimes, because he had a show on Saturdays. And I would hang out at the radio station. Not too many women. Not too many. I remember one. And there was one other woman who was on a radio station in the town where I went, and she was a hero to me, and she helped me, and she, you know, encouraged me. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where making the leap to public radio was not a totally conscious decision, but I think my heart was moving me in that direction. And so moving into public radio and then coming here to what I call more community-based radio. It is public radio, but it has more of a community feel than a lot of NPR stations do. I just feel lucky. I feel lucky. I'm not saying it was pure chance, because I walked through all those doors. I made those choices and I went toward those things, but they were there, you know, and there were people welcoming me in. So, yeah, it's been pretty awesome.
Let me ask you what you think about the opportunities for women in public media today, especially in comparison to what it might have been like back in the late 60s, early 70s, before NPR really started to cook.
How is it different now? Well, a couple weeks ago, we went to Columbus to the AP Awards ceremony, right? Several hundred people in that room. And they were both radio and newspaper folks. And, you know, I had a chance to stand up and say a few things on WISO's behalf. And I'm looking out there, and it was mostly women. In my eyes, that's what I saw, mostly young women. Not just young women, mostly women. And I was really struck by that because that was not the way it was back in the day. It just wasn't that way. So I'm really happy about that. I think there's great opportunity. You know, I'm sure podcasting is similar. There's as many women as men, maybe more, going into podcasting. So it's just not a barrier anymore. The barriers are more, you know, race and prejudice than they are about women and men, because that seems to me in public media not as big a problem as it was. We need to make more opportunities for people of color, women of color. But there's more, you know, I see some progress along those lines. There's a long way to go, even at NPR, even at NPR. So it's better. I have lots of women ask me about young women, you know, like who are searching for a career. And I'm so eager to tell them how great it is to make media. Because, right, you get to sit down and talk to people, ask questions, read books, read newspaper articles, learn about history, go into people's houses, go to events. I mean, you're able to be out in the world and using your creative powers to interpret that, to figure out what is life, what is this world we live in, you know, how do I make sense of this? We never stop asking those questions, like, what is this that we are doing here? And making media gives you that, demands that you be that person asking those questions, right? So I feel really lucky. I feel really lucky.
Okay. Thank you, Nina.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is a good conversation. It was a long one, too.
Yeah.
Good. Well, let me turn all this stuff off here.
Be sure to listen for more Rediscovered Radio, Women's Voices, Women's Music, in the WYSO archives. And if you haven't yet followed us on your favorite podcast app, what are you waiting for? There are more full episodes coming your way and more bonus episodes, too. I'm Jocelyn Robinson. Thanks for listening.